Under the skin, 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 under the skin.
All right, well, I'm really, really happy to announce that Under the Scales is coming out of its hibernation, and season two is officially begun. And I mentioned on Facebook that something is stirring the water and making, you know, making me wake up, making me want to do Under the Scales again. And that happened to be running into a good friend named Jason Pinsky. Hey, Jason, how are you?
I'm great, Tom. It's great to be here.
I'm so happy to be here. There's a lot going on with Under the Scales right now. I did have a blissful 3 months off, which was kind of nice. But it was really great running into you, and I realized there's so much happening with you that involves fish and that would be interesting to my audience that I couldn't not press record, you know, before you scurry off to the West Coast again.
So, yeah, well, I've recently relocated to California.
Right, right. You're like one of those like college students where like all your infrastructure is still with your parents, you know, but you live in some other place. Like I noticed you just came back to New York to go to the dentist.
Yeah, right. And actually, Dr. Ari Kramer, he's unofficially known as the Grateful Dentist. And we were just talking today about how CBD mouthwash should actually be a thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, already it came into Jason brought it up without my even having to broach the subject. You may have heard the reference CBD, so that refers to
It's called cannabidiol. It's one of the cannabinoids. It's one of the medicinal ingredients that
one of the components of
cannabis.
Cannabis.
Yeah, correct.
And Jason, if there's a way to describe Jason, it's like the cannabis guy.
I mean, honestly, I like to give credit to the entire community that's pushing this movement forward. I'm a spoke on in a wheel in something that's much bigger than me and much bigger than us, and really can make a serious impact on humanity on a global scale.
Jason and I met a long time ago in fish, through fish, and it probably was in the 93 time frame or 94, 95. But even back then, I remember, you know, you had an incredible affinity toward weed. And it's amazing how you've turned it into a profession.
Yeah, well, you know, I made my living in technology, right? So you'll hear me talk about the Pinsky Triangle in my narrative.
Right.
And at the top of the triangle, it was tech, right? Because technology was kind of how I made my living. And then my passion points at the two bottom points of the triangle were music and production and media, obviously, on one side, and then weed on the other side.
That's incredible. So you, with that triangle, you've kind of structured your entire life around that triangle.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a three-point geometry is a two-dimensional triangle,
right.
Okay? And I'll fast forward to later on in life when I added food into the matrix. And that was four-point geometry, which actually is a three-dimensional triangle.
Like a pyramid.
Like
maybe.
A pyramid, yeah. And actually, a pyramid is one of the, is I believe, the most geometric, like
stable structure.
Stable structure, yeah, exactly. But really what the
sphere might be.
You know what? I'm going to have to ask some people that know more than me. But
well, look at planets. I mean, they're not triangles.
True, but I do believe that the Pinsky Triangle, as it relates to me, is really been about establishing these points
right. And
connecting the dots. And my narrative talks a lot about how music, right, led me to cannabis.
Yeah.
And music also led me to technology. And we'll talk a little bit about how fish played a role in that.
I could kind of say the same thing. I was one of the few, I mean, people our age, and I know I'm older than you are, but I was right there witnessing when, like, keyboard synthesizers went from analog to digital and the mating of computers and music. I kind of watched the whole thing happen.
And I was right there when when analog went to digital from a recording perspective.
Oh, gotcha.
When it went from cassette to DAT recorders and that kind of, you know, led to the whole digital audio movement.
All right. Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves. There's so much I want to talk to about with Jason, so much so that we even have a little bit of an outline because we realize there's too much in one episode, but there's some important stuff I have to talk to you really quickly about Under the Scales that we just have to get out of the way if we can before we start talking.
Great.
And one of those is that Under the Scales is now a member of a community of podcasts called Osiris. Check that out at osirispod.com. But it's a bunch of my friends, and right now we're 20 music podcasts. Soon we're going to be a lot more, and I'm excited to be a member of it, and it's already opened my eyes and opened my world in many ways. So that's pretty cool. That's Osiris.
Osiris.
But also, I'm really proud to announce that we have two sponsors. We have Bullet Bourbon, which you might know something about, Jason.
Well, it's interesting because bourbon is actually my my alcohol of choice, and I'm more on the weed team,
right,
than on the alcohol team,
right.
But I do enjoy a good bourbon neat.
Yeah,
two fingers, four fingers.
So unlike you being on the weed team, I'm on the alcohol team, I'd say primarily. However, I'm a staunch advocate of, you know, cannabis rights. But my vice of choice, if you call these vices, they might not be vices. They might actually be good for you, at least in marijuana.
Let me correct you on that. Marijuana is definitely, let me correct you on that. Cannabis is definitely good for you.
Okay. So not a vice, really, technically?
It can be, just like anything.
Okay.
Overuse or of any substance, even drinking too much water could be detrimental to your health. But we look at cannabis as a dietary supplement these days. And, you know, the chemicals that are in the plant actually exist naturally in our bodies. And by consuming these phytocannabinoids from the plant, we're actually supplementing the endocannabinoids that exist in our bodies. And the endocannabinoids and the receptors that they bind to are responsible for the human body's ability to maintain something called homeostasis, which is chemical balance.
That's perfect. Well, sometimes when I come home after a long night and I need to achieve homeostasis, if it's not beer, I do reach for Bullet Bourbon.
Oh, well, there you go.
And that's it's I'm not really a huge distilled liquor drinker. I like wine and beer, but when I do, it's tequila or bourbon. And I've always, for whatever reason, had a Bullet Bourbon bottle in my cabinet, and so I was very happy to have Bullet approach me and ask me, you know, through some friends who happen to be fish fans, if Bullet Bourbon could sponsor Under the Scales. And I said yes immediately because, A, they're my first sponsor. B, I drink it, and it's got a smoky, oaky flavor. And you like it too?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I have frequently gone to a bullet to the brain, so to speak.
Well, so Bullet, I was just looking, has an interesting past. I was kind of just realizing that the guy's name, the founder, is Tom Bullet, but it turns out it's not. He refound his grandfather Augustus Bullet's recipe. So this guy Augustus Bullet, 150 years ago, came up with this amazing rye heavy bourbon recipe, and it was a smash hit back in the 1800s. And bizarrely, and a mystery that hasn't been solved yet, Augustus Bullet disappeared on a distribution run, and luckily the recipe wasn't lost with him. It was saved and handed down, and a couple generations later, 1987, Tom Bullet started mass producing it, and the rest is history.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And we have a little bit right here, and let's have a sip.
Well, cheers to you, my
cheers.
Friend.
Cheers, yeah. By the way, if you want to learn more about Bullet Bourbon, it's bullet.com, and that's BULLEIT.com. Now, my second sponsor is one that you'll be incredibly familiar with, Kush Bottles.
Amazing.
Yeah, so you do have some past with them. My Kush Bottles is it's the nation's largest and most respected distributor of packaging supplies and accessories for the cannabis industry.
Well, this is what's really important, is that state regulations require packaging to be compliant for child-proofing and also labeling and whatnot. So Kush Bottles has done a really great job in supplying the industry with packaging that is compliant and also available.
They know the regulations in every state, and they provide products that comply to those regulations.
Correct.
Plus, it looks good. It doesn't look like the old drugstore orange bottle with the white cap. You know, they brand it in their way.
It's really good. And actually, just to tie it all together, there is a direct connection between the leadership at Kush Bottles and Phish.
Why don't you tell me what that is?
I'm going to have to look it up. But I was at a trade show, and I'm at the Kush Bottles booth, and you know, you're having conversation about weed, and then music comes into it. So yeah, we're all fans, so to speak.
Okay, right. Well, we're everywhere, so that doesn't surprise me. I know a guy named Jerry in Kush who's a huge Phish fan.
Okay.
I'm not sure if he's the guy you're talking about.
You know what? Here's the thing with me these days. I don't really know everyone that I know. Okay? You know, it's and it gets complicated when you have, like, good friends who you've known for 20 years, and then you... I would say it's not that you're forgetting. Well, cannabis and short-term memory have gone hand in hand for a long time.
Yes.
And there's actually some science behind that. The five core functions of the endocannabinoid system are to eat, sleep, relax, forget, and protect. And forget is the one that comes into play when it comes to the fact that I just can't remember anything anymore. So, you know, anytime it comes up in conversation where I have... A memory lapse. I just refer to it as me having a highly functioning endocannabinoid system.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, I should just go back to some of the crazy things you have sitting in front of us right now, because we were talking about Kush Bottles. All the new crazy ways of consuming cannabis that I honestly wasn't aware of, Kush Bottles has packaging for it.
Correct.
So, like, that joint tube over there.
Yep.
That looks like it could be child resistant.
Yep.
And so that would hold one joint, so you'd take that to work with you for your lunch break or whatever.
The way that the child-proof packaging works is sometimes you've got to, like, squeeze the packaging separate in a special way.
Right.
On the bottles, you have to push and twist, almost very similar to how a prescription medicine bottle.
So very imaginative. Hopefully it doesn't keep the stoners out, but it does keep the kids out.
Actually, I've gotten really frustrated at some points trying to open up some of this child-proof packaging, because it's like Pinsky proof at the end of the day.
Well, Kush does a good job. So they have headquarters in Santa Ana, California. Is that kind of near where you are?
Well, yeah. So I've relocated to California after 44 years in New York. And I'm in Los Angeles, but more specifically, I'm on the west side of Los Angeles in Venice.
Got it. Okay, cool. They're also in Washington and Denver. So check out Kush and check out their amazing products. They have all kinds of vaping supplies as well.
Yeah.
They're at kushbottles.com. So Jason, going backwards down the number line, so to speak, when was the first time that you saw Phish and really connected with them?
Well, I should say I connected with the band prior to seeing them.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole tape trade thing was really a huge piece of the music becoming available to guys that hadn't yet had the opportunity to see the band. In high school, I remember a guy named Mike Formica. Mike was a year older than me, and we used to ride around in Mike's Mercedes. It was a diesel Mercedes. It was actually, I'm remembering it as a Model 420.
You would.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, if we're keeping it real, I'm not sure if it was a 420, but for purposes of storytelling, let's just go with that.
All right.
And Mike and I used to drive around and listen to Phish shows. Wetlands 3390 was the first show that I actually remember vividly hearing on tape, and one of the first, if not the first Phish tape that I had.
If I can get a version of that, I'll put a little bit of that up right now.
Well, specifically, you want to think about the first time I heard Mike's tune.
Okay.
And also in that show was a lot of Gamehenge content. We'll be right back.
And this was game. This was Wetlands.
This was Wetlands 3390. I don't have the set list, but
so
if you...
I missed very few shows at Wetlands. So that could have been when you and I met the first time.
Well, no, I wasn't there.
Okay.
I actually just heard it on tape.
Okay.
And so it was that I heard on tape. I had heard the White Album on tape. I heard some the 1991 Amy's Farm shows on tape.
Oh, right.
And then I started really, you know, my first Dead shows were in the late 80s. So I was getting Dead tapes, and I was already in the process of, I was part of the taper community.
Right.
Since then. And when I first saw Phish, it was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at the Music Hall. It was the tour opener. I believe it was March 6th and 7th, 1992.
92, okay.
But prior to that, I'd say that Fishnet and Rec Music Fish and
yes.
the news groups.
Rec.music.fish.
Rec.music.fish. So basically, I started a career in technology, and my first inspiration and desire to get online was to really learn more about this band. And I remember I was at the University of Hartford, and I bought my first modem. It was 300 baud, okay?
Right.
And it allowed me to connect to the VAX, which was the Unix server on
this
campus.
This sounds a lot like the conversation I had with like Andy Gadio.
Yeah, of course.
Some of those guys who were really early also on Unix machines.
Yeah.
Tapping into the rec.music.fish
world. Yeah, so yeah. That was really my introduction to getting online.
Yeah.
Was becoming a nerd.
And the funny thing is you find there's other guys out there. I mean, now... Kids, or no, I shouldn't say kids, now anyone can find groups of people that are into what they want, no matter how esoteric, and that's like natural on the internet. For us, imagine like you're like a nerdy computer science student, like in the bowels of the science building on a computer, and somehow reaching your tendrils out and connecting to a Phish fan. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was really some next level It was amazing.
Yeah, it really was.
And I would say that it not only enabled us as the fans to connect, and this was really happening all over the world. I mean, you were, you know, the internet really, before it became dial-up or broadband in people's homes, was really started with these Unix servers.
It was a way of connecting university Unix machines. Because other than that, it was like military.
Yeah, correct. As a matter of fact, that's correct. So really, you know, in 1991, University of Hartford, and I'm on Phish.net, and I remember vividly learning really a lot about, and it just so happened that a lot of the people that were on Phishnet were also tapers, okay?
Oh, right, yeah.
So that was, I think, really the genesis of finding your tribe. Right. You know, when you go to see Phish, especially these days, right, in arenas and 20,000 people, you go to festivals, 60,000 people.
You need your little group.
The taper section was always the place where you can run into the same people.
Right.
You know, I would actually, you know, it's funny. You did an interview with Big Phil.
Yes.
Phil and I didn't actually meet. Well, we were both in the taper section.
Right.
But the reason we became friends was because we would always wind up at Denny's after the Phish shows.
That sounds like on the way home from Philly, there's a Denny's if you go to New Jersey from there or New York from there.
There's actually a Denny's within proximity of all of the Phish shows that happened in the early 90s. And Phil and I would wind up there.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So
always open and consistent food.
Basically. And I mean, I haven't frequented Denny's in quite some time, but it is actually a part of my my history in that. But the first show that I actually got to see was Portsmouth, New Hampshire at the Music Hall in February. And that was an epic show as a first show because of a couple of reasons. Picture of Nectar had just dropped in February.
Right.
Okay. And a month later, the band basically debuts Rift. Okay, they were at that show. It was the first time they played Rift. It's the first time they played Maze. First My Friend, My Friend. The first Mound. First time in an intensive care unit, and the first Sleeping Monkey, which was the encore.
The feeling's not the same. In fact, it's getting pretty tame. It's just not that great anymore. I guess I'll go outside and flag a weasel for a ride. Take it on down to the shore.
Nice.
And I remember seeing that show because I had been seeing live music for years at that point. Minkin did the backdrop.
Yeah. So Mike's mom, I guess, was hired by Phish to do a huge art, which was on like some black kind of canvas or something.
It was actually on Lexan. It was like Lucite.
Oh,
and
wow.
There was this paint, and basically it was lit from the front and from the back.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, the thing about seeing Phish in this theater, and I had been seeing shows at Wetlands since I was 16, so I had been to like clubs in the city, in New York City.
Yeah.
But when I went up to see Phish, it was more like a Broadway show.
There was a tiny bit more visual component or something.
There was a full performance element to it that was beyond just a band going on stage and playing songs.
Right. Even though when you think of like a performance with a band, you think of costumes and crowd. Phish would never, ever do that. Well, John Fishman would. But you know what I mean? Like, it's funny to hear you saying that because so many people would... with the bands out there and some of the shows and elaborate stuff that happens now, would never ever say that about Phish. But I know exactly what you mean.
Well, I think a lot of the reason why that came to be also was not just because there was an amazing light show, and not only because the band was, I think the band was really interacting with the audience. And that was also the first show that they talked about the secret language and the instructions for the secret language.
I think you hit sort of on the key right there. Was the interaction with the audience.
Yeah.
You could go and, you know, you could convene with a song or you could freak out on the lights. But the language, suddenly the band was talking and using your interaction as well, interacting directly with you.
Well, starting in March of 92 is when it was the first time that the secret language was actually talked about during the show. And then it was, you know, teased right throughout the rest of the year. And it was at Matthews Arena, New Year's 92.
They did a multiple?
Well, what happened was on New Year's, they actually gave out pieces of paper that had the instructions for the secret language. So now this was the first time that it was in print.
This is coming back to me.
Yeah. And the best thing about it was for those of us that knew about it.
Yeah.
Versus everyone else that was there that didn't know about
right.
it, right? So there was this, there was a few different cues, right?
There was the opportunity to teach the newbies.
Well, and also to freak out the newbies, right? So there was the all fall down cue. Exactly. So like you're in the middle of a hairy jam.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden Trey does the trill and does the descending notes. And then like literally, if you knew about it, you would just collapse on the floor as if you had just died. Okay. Or The Simpsons, right? Where in the middle of a hairy jam and everyone would be like, "Doh!" You know?
What's it called when they do that at malls? You're walking through a mall. And
it's a mob or something. A flash mob. Flash mob.
Yeah. It was kind of like that.
Yeah.
People would freak out because there was another one where you would turn around.
Well, true. And that was so basically they did the secret language instructions. And yeah, it was to everything, turn, turn, turn. OK, but this was really when I started to realize that that when you were tapped in, if you're part of the Taper community, which I actually wasn't yet in 1992, I was still part of the general audience,
okay.
I should say.
All right. But
it was in 1993 that I moved into New York City. And I started going to see shows in New York City. And I also, at the same time, my first DAT recorder was, I believe, a Sony D7, little portable recorder.
Right.
And I was recording Phish shows. And then I was like, wow, man, you know, going to see music in New York, 3-4 nights a week. You know, I had my tech job during the day, right? That was at the top of the triangle. And then my passions were music and weed. And the music part and the production part was realizing that there's all this great music that was happening around New York City. And I'm at these shows and nobody is recording it. Nobody's capturing this for history.
It'd be unheard of now. But back then, you saw a terrible wrong happening.
Well, yeah. And interestingly enough, we're recording today's show at a studio called Music Works. Music Works is owned by my good friend Chris the Burge. And Chris was the conga player, is the conga player for Groove Collective. Groove Collective was the first band that I had approached and seen, and these guys would really, they were the pioneers of what was referred to as the acid jazz movement. And it stemmed from a weekly party that used to be called Giant Step that happened in the early 90s.
Oh,
and Giant
God.
Step was like kind of the convergence of the jazz cats in the downtown music scene and the hip hop culture that was happening. And they would throw this weekly party where there would be guys doing live art and there would be a DJ. And then you would have these band, these musicians that would come up on stage and start playing with the DJ.
That I know I was at the Wetlands, where Groove Collective opened for Widespread.
Correct.
And that's kind of like when I walked in here today and saw your friend Chris.
Yeah.
I kind of felt I knew him, and it turns out he's the conga player for Groove Collective.
Yeah, actually, I have the letter that I wrote to the band back in like 93. And it was like, hey, guys, you know, I'd like to basically come down and not just record the shows for me, but record the shows for you.
Oh.
You know, there's two ways to make it in the music industry, right? You can either be somebody's kid,
yeah,
or you can have really good weed. And I think that was the one of the tickets that I would go. I would record the shows. I'd hook up the band with some weed.
Right.
And there's really a connection between how cannabis culture and music culture really got intertwined, because if you look at the lineage and the history of the Grateful Dead and how the Dead would tour across the country, and then Fish actually, you know, stepped into that role as well, guys would go on tour and they would sell weed. You start the tour in California on the Dead tour, and they would go across the country.
Right.
And the same thing happened. So really my introduction, I'd say, to the top shelf growers,
right,
came from music, and specifically Dead Tour and more Fish Tour. You know, I came into Dead Tour in the late 80s, kind of like at the tail end.
Right.
I consider Fish really, you know, for us, it's really what we were bred on, so to speak. You know, I consider the Dead like, you know, our parents' band, so to speak.
Okay. I mean, I'm right there with you, although I'm of the age where I could very well have been brought into this by the Dead, and then found Fish later, like a lot of the taper community.
Yeah.
And it wasn't sort of my thing for whatever reason, although going to the Grateful Dead with Trey is still one of my favorite memories.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was that could have been the Meadowlands was definitely one of them, but I think it was also RFK.
Oh, great. Stadium, yeah. I was that was my East Coast circuit. We would do the Giant Stadium shows. We did Brendan Byrne Arena,
yeah,
and RFK. I remember RFK shows were always around the time of Father's Day.
Oh, okay. And I also remember RFK was so hot, and people were spraying. There were people on the side of the stage, like roadies, spraying fire hoses way up in the air, and it would like rain down on you. But by the time it got down, because it evaporated, it was just sort of a mist, but it cooled everyone by about 10 degrees.
Yeah.
And we needed it because there were people, we were handing women out across the audience that had fainted.
Oh, and like body
crowded.
Surfing?
Yeah, but they were unconscious.
Wow.
Just handing them, like getting them to the side, because I was up in the crowded, squished area. And so I guess the combination of heat plus, you know, being squished wasn't the best for some people.
Well, that used to happen a lot at the Wetlands. Okay, we used to call it the sweat glands. Okay, and I've on more than one occasion remember passing a joint of probably at the time it was the Chem Dog. It was Chem 91. And then all of a sudden you'd see like people just drop, like go down. And it was a combination of getting a little too high, and then also having back by the stage in the back, there was limited air circulation. Fortunately, there was the stage door. So if you were caught right in the back and you did pass out, security was able to bring you outside pretty easily back in the day.
Well, I can sense you're wanting to tell us a little bit about weed. So weed went through a little bit of a renaissance in the early 90s, right? Isn't that kind of where the really, kind of like what we're seeing or what we have seen over the past 10 years with beer? It's like we went from, you know, terrible beer selection and all of a sudden, you know, Anchor Steam or Sam Adams suddenly start to get better. And then all of a sudden there was Sierra Nevada. And then all of a sudden all these independent, amazing beers popped up.
Well, the craft beer industry, right?
Right.
And
craft.
Back in the day with weed, you know, it was really like my first introduction to weed in the mid-80s was Mexican schwag, as we call it.
Yeah.
I remember vividly having to de-stem and de-seed.
De-seed, yeah,
the
on
weed.
A frisbee.
And then Sensimilla, right? Seedless cannabis really became a thing in the late 80s. There were a bunch of guys from California, Rob Clark, Dave Watson, Sam the Skunk Man, right? These guys went over to Amsterdam. Holland was really the capital of the world of flora, flowers, indoor
okay.
greenhouses.
Right.
So cannabis production really became really relevant in the late 80s.
Oh, okay.
When a lot of these guys brought genetics and seeds from California over to Holland.
Okay.
Okay. And but it was the same story how, for example, the ChemDog story. It's a legendary story that stems from Deer Creek shows, Noblesville, Indiana, June 6th and 7th, 1991. That's the Grateful Dead. And one of my good friends, Greg, was at this show. And you know Shakedown Street, right?
Yes.
Shakedown is where the
vendors sell anything. And
well,
everything.
And not only tie dyes and veggie burritos and grilled cheese sandwiches, but really good head stash.
Okay.
And other substances that enhanced
exactly
these shows. And the story goes, my friend Greg bought an ounce of weed, 1991. It was from two dudes, one named Joe B. and the other named P. Bud. And these guys had brought their weed from Colorado, and they had brought it on tour. And by the time it had gotten into Noblesville, Indiana, Greg had bought this ounce. It was $500 an ounce in 1991.
$500. Wow. That would be a million an ounce today.
Well, you know what? Those were like lot prices, as
okay.
we say. You know, it was always a little bit more expensive
okay.
on the lot.
Right.
And after summer tour, G kept in touch with these guys and got 2 ounces of it sent out. He sent $1,000 out west and had 2 ounces sent to Massachusetts, to Western Massachusetts. And in the bag of weed were 13 seeds, okay? And those 13 seeds were the legendary ChemDog seeds. And this is what really started, you know, this whole movement. Greg popped these seeds. The first one we refer to as the original Chem Dog. It's called Chem 91. The second one was the Chem Sister. The third one, right, because they're female, right? The third one was a male. And, you know, the reason why we're able to have seedless cannabis is because when we cultivate, we separate the males and the females so that the males don't pollinate the females. So therefore, you get seedless weed.
Right. Okay.
And so G destroyed the third one, actually killed off the male because he didn't want it to seed the females. And that actually, in hindsight, if he would have kept that and kept it isolated, then we could have actually used that to breed further strains. That's
right.
How these breeders actually go and create new genetics is by taking pollen from a male plant and introducing that to different female plants. And that's how you get all these amazing crosses.
Right. OK.
So, yeah, that was really the story. I didn't know G in 1991. I met him in 1994. Which was my first really exposure to a regulated cannabis marketplace. In the summer of 1994, I had moved into the city in 93. I was working at my dad's company at the time. I remember seeing in the back of High Times a little ad that said, Cannabis Cup, November, judges applications, and there was an address that you could write to apply to be a judge. And I actually have the, I don't have it here with me, but I actually have the original letter that I had written and then the response. Actually, I don't have the letter I wrote because I had given it to them.
Right.
But I have the return mail that
nice.
I had gotten from High Times that says, congratulations, you've been selected as a judge.
Oh, my God.
And had all the travel packages and all this stuff. And on the flight, because here's what they did. They chartered a flight It wasn't exclusive to judges,
right.
But there were around 40 of us that were all on the same flight. And you have some legends in cannabis that were on that flight. Amongst them were Jack Herer. Jack wrote a book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes that I would also read about in the end of high, in the back of High Times. That was really the first book that talked about cannabis as medicine and hemp as an industrial product. And right. It really demystified and kind of laid out the history of why cannabis and hemp were so important. And it was the first book I read. And I'm on this plane in Amsterdam. First of all, Jack was on the cover of the November edition of High Times, which I had with me. And I turn around in the back of the plane, and
there's Jack.
There's Jack. He's sitting there. I actually have his autograph. We were talking about magic mushrooms, and the autograph goes something like to Jason. It's November 23rd, 1994, and it says Mid-Atlantic, like we're flying over the ocean. And the quote was something like, let's have a blast and some boomers in Amsterdam with love, Jack Herer.
And your memory seems fine to me, Jason.
Well, actually, I have that written down.
Oh, okay.
I didn't rediscover that I actually kept that.
No, but I mean, dates and stuff, they seem to come fairly freely to you.
Well, yeah, it's the long-term memory I don't really have a problem with. It's just what we talked about a minute ago that I might not be able to recall. Short-term memory is really, but once it's committed to memory, then it's a lot easier.
Well, if I know that I'm interrupting potentially 5-hour narrative about marijuana. You love talking about weed. You love smoking weed during interviews, I can tell. Jason has a double barrel thing that attaches to his ring with a magnet. It's kind of bizarre. This is a pretty interesting looking vape pen. I love this stuff. Pot smoking and consuming has gotten so completely exciting and new. I'm enjoying edibles. I don't really like smoking that much. Mentally, I can cope with the idea of knowing exactly how much I'm getting. And I really like that about the edibles.
Proper dosing and proper delivery
is
everything.
Right.
The reason I prefer to inhale my cannabis is, unlike edibles, sometimes the labeling in especially like California, for example, just hit regulation just at the beginning of this year.
Right.
So now everything has to be lab tested.
Okay.
But prior to that, you know, you could think you're eating 10 milligrams and it could be, you know, 100.
Well, I definitely have noticed sort of fluctuations in that.
You have to be careful with edibles because they stay in your body.
Gotcha.
Okay. So when you smoke weed or hit a vape pen, you're inhaling and exhaling, and it's in your body and it's out of your body.
Right.
When you consume edibles, it's in there for a long time. The other thing, just to get a little technical, is edibles are frequently made with cannabis that has been heated, right? If you think of cookies and brownies, you have to put that stuff in the oven. And when you expose THC to heat, it activates it.
In a good way.
Well, what happens is THC starts out on the plant as something called THCA, which is the precursor to THC.
Okay.
And it's non-psychoactive. When you add heat, that's when it converts from THCA to THC, and that's when it can pass the blood-brain barrier.
If I ate a bud off a plant, I wouldn't get stoned?
That's correct.
Oh, wow.
Now, if off a living plant, if you ate a bud off a plant that had been curing, you know, most people say after you cut your weed, you cure it for a couple of weeks.
Converts from A to regular?
What happens is there's kind of like a temperature curve. So at a high heat, the conversion will happen almost instantly.
Oh.
At room temperature, it'll take time. It'll happen over a...
But it does happen.
Oh, it does happen, absolutely. But these days, people are taking cannabis leaves and juicing them, right? Cannabis is the new kale. Okay, so it's actually a superfood, and it's non-psychoactive. But edibles are can be tricky, but not only because it stays in your body, but because when in the preparation process, you're exposing the oil, basically, to heat for an extended period of time.
Right.
When you smoke a joint, you're getting like a low dose. Flower tests at typically somewhere between 15 and 20% THC.
Okay.
Okay. Now, that's actually 15 to 20% mostly THCA.
Okay.
When you smoke that joint, the cherry, the heat on the end of that joint,
yeah,
is actually causing a chemical reaction. during consumption.
It's going from A to THC.
It's going from THCA to THC. But the thing is, it's not prolonged for an extended period of time. So when you smoke a joint, you may be getting 5 to 10% active THC.
Okay.
When you take that THC, that cannabis oil, you make butter or however you put it in your edible, and you expose that to heat over a long period of time, it's activating it to 100%.
Okay. Wow.
So that's why people find a much different experience, and why it can go from, hey, this is, you know, providing a really great glow, to, wow, this is like too much.
Way too much.
The good news is that you can't overdose on THC.
Right. Just mentally, you can be uncomfortable.
It could be uncomfortable. And if you mix it with alcohol, okay, what happens is the smoking weed or consuming cannabis, it actually opens up the capillaries, and alcohol can get more into your bloodstream when you have cannabis in your system.
Wow.
So the reason why people sometimes get nauseous or feel the spins when you combine cannabis with alcohol.
There's a cross reaction.
It's actually you're getting drunker, so to speak.
Wow.
So that's, you know, some of the science behind that.
Interesting. So Jason, where did you and I first hook up, and do you remember in the old days?
Well, let me say my memory before we get to that. My memory is somewhat hazy.
Do you remember that you said that already?
No, I have no memory of that. There were a couple of points that that stood out. Some of the things that I obviously I remember my first show in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I remember also probably the most memorable show for me was in Schenectady. It was May 17th, 1992, and it was at Union College. And actually, this was a secret show, so this was not part of the announced tour.
Oh, okay.
It was supposed to be for students only of Union College.
Right.
And, this show just came out on livefish.com.
Really?
You can head over to livefish.com and you can download the May 17th, 1992 show at Union College. And one of the songs, if not the highlight of that show for me, was what I refer to as the possum that changed my life. Okay? That possum included secret language cues from The Simpsons, All Fall Down, the Aw Fuck signal.
Oh, yeah.
As well as teases. In this possum, they played Rocky Mountain Way, L.A. Woman, China Grove, and then they also teased It's Ice and Divided Sky. This was also, I had heard Gamehenge on the Wetlands tape, which was back in Wetlands 3390. But the first time I really heard Gamehenge live was at this show at Union College.
Wow.
And it was really a very memorable experience. And it felt like also, like, again, if you were a student at Union College, then tickets were on sale. But you really had to be part of the core fish community and be reading about this on Fishnet to even know.
Okay,
well, to even know that there was a show going on that night.
Right.
First time I think I remember meeting you was probably at the Betty Ford.
Oh my God! Yeah, I don't know if we've talked enough on Under the Scales about the Betty Ford Clinic. It's just such a first of all, the name Betty Ford as the the president's wife had a major alcohol problem. And did actually have to go into a clinic and be treated for alcoholism, I think, a few times during his presidency. I don't remember exactly my presidential history.
Well, I think it was more than that. I mean, look, so the Betty Ford, my access at Fish, I remember getting my first after-show stickies in the early 90s. And then after I started working with Groove Collective, I started working with Modesky, Martin & Wood. And the significance and the tie-in between Modesky, Martin, and Wood was at Summer Tour. I think it was maybe even Horde Tour or at these shows in the mid-90s. In between sets at Fish, They would play Modesky Martin and Wood. I think it was Notes from the Underground.
Totally. Yeah. Yep.
So.
And that would be. Do you think that would be Paul doing that?
You know, I would assume so.
I think it was Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, it was like this. In the Tapers section, I had met Big Phil, of course, Kevin Shapiro. Who else do I remember? Steve Logan was a friend back in, who was also in tech, who was a taper. And Kevin got the tapped by the band to become the archivist for Phish. And what that did was that kind of opened the door to the concept of a band really having. I mean, Dick started that, obviously, with the Dead.
Right. Dick's Picks and all
right,
that.
Right, Dick's Picks and all that. But Kevin, who was my friend through the Tapers section, became the archivist for Phish. And I had been doing something similar for Groove Collective. A guy named Josh Roseman played trombone for Groove Collective, and he sat in on the early Modesky Martin and Wood albums.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there's this whole downtown jazz and music scene that really was linked up a lot of the artists and a lot of the people that were playing downtown in music. And in 1996... they were at the Knitting Factory, and I approached the band, and that's when I started working with Modesky Martin and Wood.
Okay.
So talking about the Betty Ford, just to kind of bring it full circle.
Right.
As I became more active in the music community, and especially started working with a band that was really loved by the guys who worked for Phish, that led to me going from like an after-show sticky to like a guest limb. And that led toward the Betty Ford.
Yes.
And the Betty Ford was... you know, it doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly. It stopped when the band stopped the second time around in 2004.
Correct. But that was where a lot of us met backstage. My earliest memories of you working for the band, you know, Brad Sands really should get a shout out, right? Brad.
I think he's been shouted out in every episode of Under the Scales. He should be.
Well, Brad was, I learned a lot from Brad. Specifically as it relates to you, Brad would always have like the cop flashlight.
Oh yeah.
You know, and he would always light up the stairs.
It was with the walkie-talkie in his hand.
And he would take the band off the stage. I remember my earliest memories of you were illuminating your path and being your personal security at shows.
That's funny. Yeah. I kind of remember that. I could use that today, like around New York City. So you were just like, you know, I'll help this big Gorky guy get through the crowd.
Yeah.
Like, Did I look like I needed the help or something?
Well, I don't know. But I mean, I was like, Tom, is everything okay? You know, can I be of assistance? You know, and I would kind of like clear the path. You know, Moses parted the seas.
Yeah.
And
I remember you coming up and doing, being sort of like, you know, it was like a mock, being mock friendly. Like, can I do anything for you?
Yeah, is there anything? Yeah, right.
And it was funny. You know, it's like, that reminds me of my kids are horrified when I pull the mock celebrity card. Like, you know, I'll be somewhere with my daughter and some lady will say, all right, well, that you got to go to the end of the line over there. And I'll kind of stop for a moment. And Anna, my daughter, knows what's coming. It's like, I'll kind of like look at her like I'm about to say something. And Anna's like, Dad. And sometimes what kind of comes out under my breath is, don't you know who I am?
Well, the best part about that is what you need is a hype man to work with.
Well, that would be you.
Right. So it's like you never want to get on the soapbox and be like, look, this is who I am. It's always better to have somebody else phrase who
you
are.
Don't
you know who that is? Yeah, exactly. That's great. So, yeah, I remember meeting you. I would say, you know, if my relationship with MMW started in 96, then it was probably in the later 90s that you and I started to hang out in the Betty Ford. One story that comes pretty memorable experience for me was as MP3s started to come in. You know, you had the taper community, and as the analog tape started to transfer to digital,
right?
Now all of a sudden you had this music that was being converted into MP3
and could be traded losslessly on the internet, and it scared everyone in the music industry.
You didn't need to, because look, there was a whole process of, you know, tapes would have to go, as you mentioned in your interview with Big Phil, they would have to be spun real time.
Yeah.
And once we converted it to digital, now all of a sudden it was easy to send someone compressed files.
Yeah.
I remember being called by Kevin and Colton, and they said, Pinsky, we'd like you to come in and kind of give us some insight as to this whole MP3 thing and explain to us what's going on. So at the time, you know, John Peluska was the band's manager, but mm-hmm. the business manager was Bert Goldstein.
Yes.
Bert, is Bert still
there? Yeah, he remains in that position today.
Yeah, right. So so we went up to Bert Goldstein's office and we sat in the big conference room, and I refer to this as like the MP3 summit. And the reason why that gets that name is because you had the management from Phish, it was Peluska and Kevin. You had Peter McQuaid, who was managing the Grateful Dead at the time. You had Bert Holman, who was managing the Allman Brothers. And then Korn, right? Capshaw, who was managing Dave Matthews.
At the time, not yet
Fish. At the time,
Fish.
Not yet Fish.
Right.
And these guys were like, so, Pinsky, tell us about MP3s. And, you know, I had experience in software.
Right.
There were two things that got me on the internet. One was Fish, and then the other thing was trading software, right? We knew that that there was a reason why Microsoft Word cost $300.
Yeah.
Because Microsoft knew that the corporations were going to pay for it.
Yeah.
And most of the people weren't going to pay for it, and they right. were going to pirate it.
Right.
So my advice to the bands was, guys, you're never going to win. You're never going to be able to enforce this. Okay? What you probably should do is figure out a way to record the shows by yourselves and make them available and make it high quality and make it affordable and make it convenient. And it's interesting, right? Like these days we have livefish.com, and that's yeah. exactly what that is.
You
and
had that insight then as the solution
yeah, because
to piracy?
Yeah, because I had seen it happen in computer software.
Right.
And there was really no way to police it and enforce it.
Yeah, but in music there's no equivalent of selling Microsoft Word to corporations.
Well, the thing was, CDs had already been established at $15.99, $16.
I know.
And that was when, you know, instead of having to buy a disc for $16, you can now start to buy, like, tracks for 99 cents.
Yeah.
And that was actually a whole weird thing in and of itself. But yeah. that really was the beginning of...
It was the beginning of the end.
Well, I wouldn't call it that. You know, I would say that, you know, music... digital music really enabled access.
Totally.
Right?
Right.
And that actually was really interesting because after the first hiatus, it was when Treyband went on tour, Brad, who I had become friends with, was at the Beacon. And I remember getting a phone call at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He's like, Pinsky, I'm up at the Beacon. I can't get my email to work. And I need it. Can you get up here?
There it is.
And that was really the genesis of my our relationship and starting to really work with the band.
Now you're working for the band being
well,
tech support.
I wasn't working for the band at that point, okay. but between the MP3 summit
yeah.
and between
now
helping
out.
Now
you're the go-to tech guy.
Yeah, and there weren't many of us that were really savvy on all of these different things.
I remember that, and yet I still remember you as being the weed guy.
Well, yeah, that was always like the dotted line to weed. But yeah, my job with Fish started... at the music festivals.
Oh.
So I had attended the Clifford Ball in 1996. I was at the Great Went in 97, Lemon Wheel in 98, Oswego in 99. Big Cypress from 99 to 2000.
You were in those burner tents.
Oh, man.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. Big Cypress was in the Indian Reservation. There's some really amazing stories that happened Yeah, I mean, that was the show that we watched the sunrise.
That was just unbelievable. Oh, yeah, the Velvet Sea when the sun came up.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until 2003 that I started officially working for the band. Jason actually called me in. At the time, in 2003, this is when we had the House of Live Fish.
Yes.
And Apple was a sponsor.
Yes.
So Apple had sent in about 30 Macs.
All those Macs, yeah.
And actually, I remember...
Back then, no one could afford a Mac.
Well, yeah. And Apple basically sent a bunch of hardware. And me and my team came in and we wired up all these Macs together and we hooked up CD burners
yeah.
and we populated iTunes with a bunch of live Fish tracks.
Yeah.
And then fans could actually come in and drag and drop and author their own mixtapes, basically.
Put it on their iPod or on a CD.
On a CD
or
at the time.
On
yep.
the phone, yeah.
This was the only tent at the festival that was air conditioned.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. So it was really amazing.
Unless and, you had an air conditioned RV, you were screwed.
Correct. So that was really, you know, I had worked the music festivals. It was the first one that I had done. It was in November of that year, 2003, when Jason said, "Hey, Pinsky, we're thinking about bringing someone on tour, and we'd like you to come out on the road with the band." My job was basically to be like a combination of tech support, because now everyone had their laptops. Everyone needed to be connected to the internet. Everybody needed to print. I mean, you know, backstage in production, there were road cases that had printers and network. And today, all the venues have internet and Wi-Fi.
Yeah, Wi-Fi is easy.
It's
easy, right? Easy to set
up. Back then, I remember in pre-production,
walk around plugging shit in and making.
Actually, I wasn't allowed to plug anything in because you had the unions.
Oh.
Okay, so what we did was I would coordinate with like the telephone company, and I would bring in like a high-speed circuit, and then I'd have to bring in a router, and I'd have to set up Wi-Fi.
A T1 line or T3?
It was a DSL probably back in the day.
Jesus.
But that was basically my role was I was the first one in the morning, setting up the infrastructure for production.
Wow.
And then I would establish a Wi-Fi network, not only backstage, but also in the venue. And at the time on Phish.com, we had a mechanism, like kind of like an admin section that would allow me to post what song they were playing. So like today we've got Phish from the Road on Twitter.
Yeah.
Right. Back in the day, it was me on a Palm Pilot in the venue. And, you know, I had been a fan for at that point, 10, 11 years.
Yeah.
And but, you know, you don't I wasn't like Kevin. I didn't know exactly every name to every song. So I remember vividly like pulling over Carini or pulling over Jimmy, you know,
what and the hell song is this?
What is this?
You know, so would you have to make those set list decisions? Like, was that a segue? All that stuff?
I was the one that was putting that stuff up. And I would
now there's a whole set list committee and people fight about that.
Well, yeah. And very often I would call Kevin and I would say, Kevin, you know,
resolve this.
What do I do here? But that was really
that was
my.
You were the first From the Road dude.
I was the first dude. Yeah. Couch Tour back in the day was me posting the set lists live as the band was playing them.
Fish.com.
And then also I had a digital camera. I remember one story, Haddon, right, who ran production.
Yeah.
Here I am. It's the Nassau Coliseum shows, November 28th, Uniondale.
All Haddon stories are about getting in trouble.
Yeah, right, exactly. So back then it was like Taylor Carruthers, Cite, or it was Danny Clinch. Those were the guys who like were allowed to be on stage.
Yep.
And somehow I had permission to take photos of the band on stage because I would post them during the show. So you would get the set lists, and then you would get a few actual photos.
So you're a trusted photographer.
Well, I was an amateur photographer, and I was also amateur in the sense that I went on stage with a white T-shirt. Okay. And Haddon is like, who the hell is this guy? I mean, like, you want to be as invisible as possible.
You have to wear stage color.
Yeah, black. Okay. And so I learned that lesson the hard way my first time officially.
You got yelled at by
Haddon? Oh, yeah, big time.
Normally when he yells at me, it's because I park where none of the trucks or buses can get in or out.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's really the thing. You know, you can get all access or you can get a guest lamb, but when you get parking, that's when you know.
That's killer.
Yeah, that parking is really everything.
But don't fuck it up like I did.
Well, or don't fuck it up like I did. Okay.
What'd you do?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, just over time as the band started to get more family oriented and for 3.0, you know, I was definitely part of the cast of characters that was there was a lot of things that went on.
Of course.
And you know, I should.
We used our privileges to keep the party going.
Yeah. And you know, as the tenure of the band continued, it really turned into the value was more on the longevity of keeping the band and keeping the band members and the organization and the movement moving forward.
Of course.
And it became, you know, it's part of the reason, or if not the reason, why there is no Betty Ford Clinic anymore.
Oh, right, right.
My last shows that I worked for the band was Coventry.
Okay, got it. Well, phenomenal. It's been so nice going back through the past with you, Jason, and hearing some of these stories, but also really gratifying to see that your pyramid, which consisted, remind me again, music.
Well,
tech,
actually, I don't
marijuana.
It was I don't refer to it as a pyramid because sometimes pyramids have negative connotations, like a pyramid scheme or something like that. So I refer to it as a three-dimensional triangle.
Okay, and but I came up with three vertices: pot, music, and tech. What was the fourth?
Food, right? Oh, so food. I opened Feta Sow in 2005. Feta Sow is a barbecue
fat pig
in Williamsburg. And I don't run the restaurant on a daily basis. I'm one of three partners. But yeah, to bring it home, it was technology. It was media, which was music and whatnot.
Right.
Technology, media, weed, and then food.
Fantastic.
And those were the 4 points on the three-dimensional Pinsky triangle.
Well, it's unbelievable. I'm so happy to have been part of at least one of those vertices. And it's also really cool to see all the cool weed apparatus you have here and the actual weed. What is that that I'm looking at in those bell jars?
Basically what we have here is three legendary strains of cannabis. One is the Sour Diesel, right? So if you think Sour Diesel is synonymous with New York, it's probably one of the first varieties of cannabis that was made popular through music, a lot of the hip-hop acts.
And I'm curious, why do you bring it along? Is it just sort of like good luck sort of thing?
Well, we're going to smoke it. Okay, so that's...
There's at least a pound of weed here.
No, it's not a pound.
I don't know what that is.
No, I'd say it's maybe 2 ounces of Sour Diesel, and then I just got... this red Congolese and some Acapulco gold, which are
wonderful.
Some amazing varieties.
I'm going to hire a private ambulance service to take me home.
No, I'll just get you an Uber. Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Before I forget, we're winding down here. I can't end the first Under the Scales episode in season 2 without asking the quintessential question, and I have a feeling you're going to have forgotten the answer. How many shows have you seen?
No idea. Let me just say that I've absolutely no idea. This is 2017
right.
Was my 25 years of seeing
of
fish.
Seeing fish. Okay.
Right? So we're in my 26th year.
We're going to give you an honorary number of 350.
I would say 420.
Okay, 420.
Yeah. I would say that I've seen 420 fish shows up to this point.
Why didn't
and
I
actually,
think of that?
The number, it'll probably stay at 420. It's always going to be, I've seen 420 shows. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, thanks, Tom. Yeah. I really appreciate the time today.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Lots of fun.
Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.